In part one, we left Anne Cooper in a boudoir with a French fashion student. And now, the conclusion of episode four of 1859.
And like, at that point, I was like, freaked out. Like, I mean, I hadn't really been paranoid till then. So at that point, I sit bolt upright in bed now. And so he was like, okay, you seem, he's like, maybe that's the wrong word. Maybe, you know, cause don't worry, because it goes into a napkin. It's like, oh my God. Like, I have no idea. Like, is this the French word for condom? Or is it like, it sounds a lot like foreskin. Like, it goes into it. Like, I don't fucking know what he's talking about, but I'm like, that does not sound good. You know, like, I was like, yeah, I kind of know what it does, you know? I can't believe this is happening. You know, I'm just sort of still staring at him. He's like, you seem really upset. And I'm like, yeah, a little bit. Like, to be honest, I'm a little upset. And he's like, I don't understand why you're so upset. And I said, well, I just think it's like, this is like a really weird way to ask somebody to have sex with you. And he's like, okay, can I show it to you? I was finally, I was like, you know, at this point, yeah, just like, let's see it. Come on, you know, like, let's just see your erection. Like, obviously that's where this night is going. I'm like fully waiting for him to like reveal himself. And the poor child like shows me that his button is in fact fallen off and he has a safety pin that he's so worried it might poke him in the middle of the night. That he, like, wanted me to know why he needed to take off his pants to sleep. And this, like, you know, sharp, hard, pointy thing is, like, otherwise known as a safety pin, which goes into some sort of diaper, which is known as, like, a napkin, which he comes out as napskin. It's like, how does, you know, it's just one of those things that I started laughing so hard, I'm sure, enhanced by the hash. And then he wouldn't have sex with me. 1859.
Mike, do you have a road story you want to tell?
It's actually a train story. After my freshman year of college, I decided to go to Europe and travel around with a backpack for a few months or whatever. I got to Europe. I went there with a friend, but by the time we got to Europe and off the plane, we already were sick of each other and went separate directions because he made noises with his mouth on the airplane that annoyed me. But
can you reproduce the sounds?
It was a very subtle sound. It was like a... And I just kind of hear it, and I'd look over him, like, and try to catch him in the act, and he'd just be sitting there reading a paper, and, like, after, like, you know, 8 hours on this flight, I was like,
stop making that sound!
So I was traveling around, and for those who've ever traveled to Europe backpack style, you end up meeting tons of other kids doing the same stupid thing, and you kind of end up hanging out together. So I traveled with a couple other people from city to city, and at one point, we were in Rome, and decided we were going to take the train, go to Bern, Switzerland next. It was kind of an overnight train. I think it's like about a 10, 12-hour train ride. It's a pretty long jaunt. So we get on the train at like 8 p.m., and I remember we got, you know, a couple loaves of bread and a couple bottles of wine, and we found our own little coachette, the little rooms on the train that you can, you know, close the curtain and door in the whole Eurail system, and we're like, we had our own coachette. This was great. And we popped open this bottle of wine, ate a bunch of bread, popped open the second bottle of wine, got a little tipsy, eventually started falling asleep. In the morning, I woke up around 6 a.m. and was still kind of half drunk, I guess, and I looked out the window, and there's snow out, and it was the mountains, and I realized I really need to take a piss really bad. So I got up, opened the curtain to our coach, had opened the door. I'm in my socks, you know, I had taken my shoes off, whatever, and walking through the train to the bathroom. Of course, I get to the bathroom car, and it's locked. Because someone else is in there. So I go to the next train car, next section. That bathroom is locked too. So I go to like three bathroom cars. I guess everyone's up and brushing their teeth or whatever, you know, in the morning and or urinating. I have no idea. I finally get like three or four cars away or something and find a vacant bathroom. And I'm in there. And while I'm in there, the train's slowing down and it comes to a stop. There's little windows and I could look out the window and I saw that the train had like a tag. It saw Brig fly by. Brig is a city in right near the border, I guess, of Italy and Switzerland or something. The train was completely at a stop. I finished taking care of business and started walking back to my train car, but I couldn't remember exactly which train car was mine. Everybody had their curtains drawn and I opened like, you know, I went to the car that I thought was mine. I remember it was like two or three down in this one specific car and I open the door and, you know, it's like some couple that's like curled up and they kind of look at me. I'm like, oh, sorry. I shut the door and I go to the next little coachette, open the door, and it's like a family. And, you know, I'm like, crap, and I can't find my thing. And I'm like, it must be on the next train section. So I go to the next train section and kind of go up and down, opening all these coachette doors, looking for my friends. And I can't find them. And I can't remember which coachette I had been in. And so I walk back towards the car where I had found the open bathroom. And the train is being separated into two sections. There's a guy who's actually pulling the pin out between the two sections. And I asked him, I said, what's going on here? Where? He's like, well, where are you going? And I said, Bern. And he goes, well, this section's going to Geneva. If you want to go to Bern, you got to get on the other section. And I was like, whoa. And so I literally hopped across to the other section in my socks while the sections are like pulling apart, you know? And I'm like, man, that was a close call. And I start going up and down looking for my friends again. And I literally opened every single coachette twice up and down this section of the train before it dawned on me that they were on the other section. We had been on the wrong section to begin with, and they were on the other section. I'm in my socks. I don't have my backpack. I don't have my passport. I don't have anything. And I'm just kind of looking out the window at the Alps going by on my way to Bern, Switzerland. And when I got to Bern, Switzerland, I think I had like 5,000 lire in my pocket, which equals like $5. I got to the train station. I threw my socks out and I got to the passport guy and I tried to explain to him, you know, and he just laughed at me and just let me go through and was like, what a moron from America. So anyway, I walked through Bern, Switzerland. I mean, I remember vaguely that day kind of just wandering around. I think I spent my last 1,000 lire on breakfast. And then I went down and saw the bears in the bear pit. And I walked down to some little water thing and looked at some half-naked women and was like, this is amazing. And it was a really beautiful day. And then it kind of really hit me that, wow, what do I do now? This is it. I think I actually called my mother. And she was like, it was like 5 a.m. I think she kind of said good luck or something on the phone. But so for the remainder of the day, I went to Einstein's house, and that was kind of fun. In barefoot, I was at Einstein's house, and eventually, I think I went back to the train station and realized this is how homeless people become homeless people. I just should pick a bench, curl up on it. You know, this is my future. I'm just going to have to start my life here in Bern, Switzerland. Eventually, I'll get a job somewhere and can buy a pair of shoes and socks. And I laid down on this bench, and it was amazing because I was kind of like in and out of sleep, you know, and for the next like hour or two. And every time a train would pull up, a horde of people would come by and then it would die and be empty for another half an hour. And at some point I opened my eyes and I saw my friends and I was just like, oh my God. And they were like pointing and laughing and like running toward, like, I think they actually dove on me because, you know, we were like boys. And they, what had happened was they had gone to, when they got to Geneva, they realized they weren't meaning to go to Geneva. They, for all they knew, that I was taking a long piss, you know, and they were even asleep when I got up, you know. And so, but these guys were amazing. They had not only taken a train back to Bern, they had brought my backpack and had my shoes and were laughing at me. And I'm still an American.
1859.
So we have Fiona Mazel here with us to tell her story of road trips. Fiona, what's your story?
So when I was, after my freshman year in college, I was living in Los Angeles. And when it was August and time to go back east, my friend Matt decided that he wanted to take a road trip to, from LA to New Orleans, where he was going to school at Tulane. I decided I would go with him. He was traveling with this guy, Brandon, who I'd not met. Anyway, we had 3 days to do it, which didn't seem like too much time, but nonetheless. Anyway, on the morning we were supposed to go, I went to go meet up with them for a breakfast meeting. And it was like 7 a.m. So I go to this breakfast meeting and his friend Brandon there. And Brandon is just the creepiest guy ever. He's kind of a, well, as I later, he's kind of an inebriate. He's a, one of these stone cold comatose inebriate guys. He doesn't talk. He doesn't gesture. He does nothing. He just sits there. And Brandon was going to sit in the back seat. I'm going to take the front. Unfortunately, Matt's car is a stick and I don't drive stick. So Matt decides that he's going to teach me in the parking lot just before we go. So we have like one of these crash course sessions and, you know, typically I can't get it out of first gear. I can't even get it into gear. But we figure once I get it into gear, we'll be set because once you're in first, it's easy to go 1, 2, 3. And, you know, it's all highway anyway. So we get in the car and it's like me in the front and Matt. And Matt's a total hypochondriac, which somehow means that he also fears for his car. He thinks that his car is going to blow up every 5 seconds, which means no air conditioning, no radio, no nothing. Because whatever you turn on, it's going to make his car explode. So we get on the road and like the car is totally packed with all of his stuff and Brandon's in the, ow, Brandon's in the back seat. Ow! Brandon has a terrarium, and in his terrarium is his turtle, Jake. And Jake is from New Orleans. He picked him up in one of the swamps and spent the summer with Jake out in L.A. And Jake now wants to bring him back to spend the year with him at Tulane. So we're driving on the highway, and we got through, like, Needles, California, and I'm driving, and I can see, like, this, like, traffic light, you know, 70 miles away, and all I can think about is to make sure it's not red when I get there, because I can't stop. Like, I don't know how to stop, and I don't know how to start. So for the hour until we get there, all I can do is think about this stoplight. And just when we get into the stoplight, and I'm, like, so psyched because it's green, and I'm like, I've made it, I haven't stopped, I turn around, because Brandon, who hasn't said a word the entire time we've been there, is, like, poking me in the shoulder, and he's, like, poking Matt, and he's getting really upset, and we turn around, and I'm like, Brandon, now what's your problem? And he's like, Jake's unresponsive. And I'm like, that's the first thing he has to say to us. Jake is unresponsive.
They're always unresponsive. That's the thing with turtles.
The thing is, Jake is dead. Jake has died in the first 6 hours of our trip. So now we have a dead turtle in this terrarium in the back, and Jake, it turns out, has a little cooler, and in his cooler is nothing but alcohol of one kind or another. So then there's much discussion about whether to put Jake in the cooler, because at least he won't decompose. I want to throw Jake out the window. No one is having this. Apparently I'm insensitive to Jake's needs. So we drive across country. Now we're going really fast because we have this turtle in our car. So we do this trip now in like 2.5 days instead of 4, because Jake is starting to reek. It is so vile. We get to New Orleans, and the first thing we do is go to Matt, the guy who was driving my friend. We go to his place of residence, which is kind of like one of these like college commune things. And it is so filthy. It's just disgusting. And Jake, or Brandon, wants to bury Jake, let him go in the swamp. And I have a plane to catch from New Orleans back to New York that afternoon. Brandon insists that I take part in the farewell ceremony for Jake. So we get to Matt's place, and Matt runs into his friend, who was a singer. She had a stage name, and her stage name was Cat Arizona. And Cat Arizona decides that she's going to come with us to the burial ceremony in the swamp. So all of us pile back into the car to go to the swamp to pay, you know, our last respects to Jake. And we get to the swamp. I'm wearing these giant blue overalls because at the time I was kind of a hippie. And so anyway, we get to the swamp and I'm wearing my giant blue overalls and it's really, really hot because it's August. So it's me and the rather heavy Cat Arizona and the sort of comatose inebriate Brandon and Matt. And as it turns out, Matt is also a blossoming homosexual. And it also turns out he has a crush on Brandon. So all of this stuff is sort of playing out on the boardwalk while we're trying to bring Jake to his final moments. We get to the end of the boardwalk. It's disgusting. It's a swamp. Brandon throws Jake, well, he releases Jake into the water. I should mention that Jake by this point is so vile. He's all shriveled. I mean, this is disgusting. I wasn't really trying to spare you like the gore of this. Anyway, we let Jake go. We have a moment. Cat Arizona... She takes a little bit of a tumble and goes right into the swamp. And mind you, the swamp is what, like 3 feet of water? It's nothing. I mean, big deal. But Matt, because he's a blossoming homosexual, also seems to have a kind of blossoming vanity and just won't go into the water. And, you know, Brandon's not having anything to do with it. And Cat Arizona is like freaking out. So, of course, I have to go into the swamp to retrieve her. Big deal, you know, it's 3 feet of water. So I go in the swamp and my big overalls also apparently retain moisture. So now I'm soaking wet, and then I have to get on my airplane back to New York, and there's no time to change, and I'm wet and disgusting, and I reek of swamp. I get there, you know, at the very last minute, and I jump on the airplane, and I sit down in the coach class or whatever, and we leave the airport, and as it turns out, I reek so badly that nobody wants to sit next to me. Like, nobody wants to have anything to do with me. And there's some complaining, and it's all extremely embarrassing. And so the stewardesses decide that they are going to bump me to first class because that way I won't offend anyone. And I get up into first class, and who should I see in first class but Alex Trebek?
1859. And now here's Nellie Reifler to tell the final road story.
My story is kind of the story of my trip back across country from the West Coast in 1994. I moved back from California. The main story that I really want to tell, however, is not the story of my trip. It's the story of my car's trip. We traveled separately. I had a great little Mazda that I hired a drive-away company to transport it across the country. It was quite an expense. I was young. I was moving for graduate school, but it seemed ultimately like a better choice than Dylan and I caravanning all the way across country. It seemed better if we could travel together. So I handed my car over to this driveway company. As we pulled into my father's driveway in upstate New York, he was putting down the phone inside with the driveway company. And by the time he came out onto the front porch to greet us, he had a very, very bad expression on his face. So the minute that we got out of the van, we knew that something was wrong. And the call that my father had just received was informing him that my car had been totaled. So I was heartbroken. I had taken really good care of this little car. It was my first car. And over the course of the next few days, as we adjusted to life back on the East Coast and we were staying with Dad, we started to get a sense of the whole story of what happened. That's the real story I wanted to tell, was the story of the young men who drove and totaled my car. So this is where the story begins.
All right. Let's
okay.
Hear it.
My car was in San Francisco, and these two young, happy men from England flew all the way to San Francisco for the Stonewall celebration there. And then they picked up my car, which they were hired to drive across country. Somewhere along the border of Utah and Nevada, whoever's driving falls asleep at the wheel. And he wakes up, and of course, he's completely confused about what side of the road he's on, because he's used to driving in England. He's never driven on the right side of the road before. So he corrects in completely the wrong way and drives my car over the median, you know, into a huge ditch, tumbles several times. The car is upside down in a ditch. And the two young gentlemen are medevaced out of this desolate stretch of highway into Salt Lake City. So the boys were really, really terribly injured. And when I heard that, that was when I stopped being angry about my car. They had both suffered some head injuries and couldn't really talk enough about who they were. When the hospital called me, they didn't know if I was a relative, if I was an employer, if I was a friend. So I kept getting these calls, and I was able to piece together what happened over the time that the guys were in the hospital. They did recover. One of them had a couple of really badly broken legs. The other one, it was just head injuries. And they started to get visits from some very nice local people in Salt Lake City. Someone had taken an interest in these boys' case because they were utterly alone there and completely bewildered. And the last I heard was the two young men, who I assume were a couple, had been taken into the home of an elderly lady from Salt Lake City. I assume that she was a Mormon, and I assume that they were taken into her fold. And to me, it's a very happy ending to the story. And I loved thinking of them recovering in the parlor of a nice Mormon lady in Salt Lake City.
1859 is written and produced by Michael Hurst and Rick Moody, and in this episode featured the voices of Ann Cooper, Fiona Mazzell, and Nellie Reifler.